Good evening. It's good to see you all. I'm sorry we're meeting in here. We were supposed to be meeting in the library, but I shouldn't really say sorry because it's simply because so many of you came. And we didn't think we could get in there still. But we're very glad to have you here, even though it means meeting in here instead. I need to just say a couple of things for those of you who are taking these lectures for an hour's credit as we get started here. You need to get to work right away on doing the reading and also watching the movies. I've tried to make the assignment as interesting as possible. Those of you who are simply come to listen to the lectures, you might want to pick up the sheet of paper on the class two in terms of the movies I've suggested that people watch. I'll just say a little bit about the four of them before we come to our first lecture. Now, the primary, first there's some reading. There's a reading packet of some essays and sections of books I've put together. The longest part of the reading packet is a section from C.S. Lewis's science fiction novel, Perelandra, or Voyage to Venus. And it's a very interesting presentation of the temptation of the first woman in that setting, and the whole issue of the problem of evil and the origin of evil. It's one of the more interesting discussions of that, I think, that's ever been written. The major text is Edith Schaeffer's book, Affliction, which I think is, as far as I'm aware, the best book written by a Christian directly about the problem of suffering. One of the most insightful and practically helpful. In terms of the movies that I've suggested that people see, one is Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors, which is some of you will have already seen, of course, and is a very fascinating study of the question, can we really say that murder is really a crime? Or is it just a misdemeanor, like speeding at 35 miles an hour in a 30-mile speed zone? Is it a crime or is it a misdemeanor? That's the issue that Allen wrestles with in this film. The second is Roman Polanski's version of Shakespeare's play Macbeth. Some of you who haven't seen this before will be very shocked by it. Shakespeare's play itself is an exploration of the issue of evil and its consequences from a biblical perspective. It presents a profoundly Christian understanding of the problem. But Polanski's film was made just a year or two after his wife was brutally murdered by people from Charles Manson's cult, who were profoundly involved in all kinds of occult and demonic practice. And this film of Macbeth really focuses on the issue of demonic evil in a far stronger way than the play itself does. And you'll see that when you get to look at it. It's certainly part of Shakespeare's play, but the film deals with it in a very disturbing way. The third is a film called Paradise Road that came out just 4 or 5 years ago, which is a film of a true historical situation of a group of women who were captured by the Japanese army during the Second World War and put in a prison camp in China. It's a very moving account of what happened to these women in that setting. And of course, also it's wrestling with the issue of suffering. And one of the primary characters in the story is a missionary, who, just like Eric Liddell, found herself in a concentration camp during the war. The fourth movie is the film that came out just last year called Wit, which is, I think, probably the finest movie that I saw that came out last year, though I doubt if most of you have heard of it. It basically simply has one character played by Emma Thompson, who is a English professor, a scholar of the English Christian poet John Donne, who was a great preacher and pastor in the early 1600s, as well as a very fine poet, one of the finest poets to ever write in the English language. And basically, the movie is really a reflection on one of Donne's poems, Death, Be Not Proud. Very moving. If any of you have struggled with cancer yourself, or have a close family member who has had to go through chemotherapy, you'll find it almost unbearable to watch. And so I warn you of that before you see it. But it's a really wonderful movie, and astonishingly well acted by Emma Thompson. There's a few other things that are required for you taking it for credit, but those of you who aren't might be interested in picking up the sheet and looking at some of these things, doing the reading for your own sake, watching the movies, and also thinking about the question that I've given you. Now, let me turn to our subject. Has everybody got a copy of the two handouts which were passed around? I didn't know quite how many to make. I wasn't sure quite how many people were going to be here. But it looks like nobody has put up their hand to say they haven't got one. So, okay, thank you. There should be some extra copies here, I think. Do we have any extra ones? Just got a few people there who don't have one. Okay. Everybody got them. So I'm going to be reading some quotations. That's why I've given you these, just so that it's easier for you to follow along. But you won't be needing them just yet, so try to hold off from looking at them until we actually get there. Even if you think they're more interesting than what I'm saying. So we'll try to... Again, I want to thank you for coming. Now, all of us live daily with the reality of the brokenness of our own lives, the lives of people we love, and the brokenness of many people around us, some we know slightly and some we don't know at all, but whose stories we hear about in the news, on the television, on the radio, in the press. Now, why is there such brokenness in people's lives? Why is there so much pain in this world? Why is there such evil? This question has become particularly acute for many people, perhaps for some of us in this room, all of us in this room, I'm sure, in new ways after the events of 9/11 last year. The images of the planes flying into the Twin Towers, of bodies falling from those high windows, of the smoke and ash, of people running away as the building collapsed. Those images will not, while we live in this world, be erased from any of our minds. You know, they're imprinted indelibly on the consciousness of the nation. Now, tonight, we're beginning a series of studies related to this subject, the problem of evil and suffering in our world. Now, I'm sure some of you would like me to get immediately to the question, is there any kind of resolution to the problem of suffering? But that's where we have to finish tomorrow afternoon. And this evening we need to start with the most basic question of all. We're going to be beginning with looking at the question, what is the difference between good and evil? And on what basis can we declare that there is a difference? We're going to then go on and look at the question of what is the origin or source of evil in our world. We're going to look thirdly at the issue of what are the sources of suffering, the suffering that many of us have endured, all of us will endure. What is the origin, what are the sources of suffering? And finally, number four, we'll look at the issue of what resolution is there to the problem of suffering. But I want to begin with this issue, and it's really the most stretching part, I suppose, of what I'm going to say. We'll start with that, even though it's the end of your work week for all of you. So you're going to be stretched this evening a little bit. But the question is this: how do we differentiate between good and evil? How do we decide what is good and what is bad? Now, to many of you, this may seem an unnecessary question, because I'm sure all of you here could point to events, to behavior, to actions that you regard as evil. But the question is, why? What is the foundation on which we build that allows us to declare that certain events are evil? We are all aware that there are those who have denied that the terrorist acts of a year ago on 9/11 were objectively evil. There are some who have said that evil is only a matter of perspective, that the terrorists thought that they were doing good. It's all right for us to search them out, to fight them, to bring them to justice, to try and punish them because of the harm they've done to this society. But can we really say that what they did was evil? Or is it only evil to us? Now, if you look at the sheet that is by itself that you all should have a copy of. This is an article from an article making this point that just was came out in U.S. News and World Report just a couple of weeks ago. And I'll read it to you. It's from an article by John Leo entitled "Rage is Not the Rage." Sociologist Amitai Etzioni sees one thing missing in all the polling data on American attitudes in the wake of September the 11th, anger. Last week, Etzioni's Communitarian Network issued the report "American Society in the Age of Terrorism, an analysis of post-9/11 polling." Sorry for the typos here. I typed this up this evening because I just got hold of this very recently. Unsurprisingly, the report finds more interest in family, spirituality and volunteerism, and more trust in government, though all these effects have begun to recede and are predicted to decline further if no new attacks occur. But there can be little doubt that by and large the American people were decidedly low-key in their expressions of anger at those who attacked us, a very unusual response to mass slaughter, Etzioni says. Why so little anger? It looks as though Alan Wolfe was right, Etzioni said. His reference is to Boston College sociologist Alan Wolfe. In his books One Nation After All and Moral Freedom, Wolf reported that non-judgmentalism is not just an ethic confined to the media and other elites. It has become normal middle-class morality. Wolf found that Americans are now morally tentative and very reluctant to criticize the behavior and attitudes of others. This makes the nation far more tolerant, but it also constructs a laissez-faire morality, a presumption that almost all behavior is beyond criticism, and that even destructive acts deserve understanding rather than judgment. Now, that's from an article just a couple of weeks ago, and reporting on polling of our nation, that there are in fact many, many people around us who are not prepared to say that the terrorist acts were objectively evil. They seem evil perhaps to us, but can we say that they are truly evil? Now, how do we respond to such a view? How will we answer the question of whether we can objectively know what is good and what is evil? And I want to begin here by looking at some of the options that people around us hold to before I turn to look at a biblical and Christian response to this question. What are some of the options? Number one, I want to say a little bit about what I'll call Western materialism or humanism. That is a view that basically says we live in a world without God, where there is just simply us and this physical universe in which we live. Now, the thought of Western society for the past 300 years has moved ever more strongly in the direction of declaring that either God is dead or God is silent, at least. And that therefore we as humans are free from God. For the first generation of those who reject Christianity and either accept a watered-down version of it, and this is true, of course, in many churches, or who become agnostic, that is, we can't really know whether God exists or anything about him, or who become actually humanist, there is no God. For most such people, we might say that the second half of the Ten Commandments are self-evidently true. They think Christianity, the Bible, God is unnecessary, but it seems self-evidently true to them that it's appropriate not to murder, not to commit adultery, not to steal, not to bear false witness against people, and so on. But this was true of my parents, who were not Christian believers, who doubted whether God existed or whether one could know anything about him. But they were extremely moral people, in the best possible sense of that word, and just assumed that those commandments were right. They taught them to us as their children, and they lived them by their example, quite wonderfully, actually, far better than many who take the name of Christ. In the first generation or two of those who turn away from Christianity or from God or from the Bible, people think it's still possible to have these moral commandments, and they continue to define evil clearly. The French writer Jean-Paul Sartre put it this way: people suppress God at the least possible expense. Don't try and find that quote. I don't think it's in those sheets. Maybe it is somewhere, but people suppress God at the least possible expense. Some, like Julian Huxley, another humanist, spoke of an ethics of reason or an ethics derived from scientific values. And if you look at the quotations here, we'll just go through a few of these on the first page there of your triple sheet. The first one is from a humanist declaration coming from the 1960s. And it's addressing the issue of whether you can have ethics without God. And they insist, yes, indeed you can. Ethics is an autonomous field of inquiry. Ethical judgments can be formulated independently of revealed religion. Human beings can cultivate practical reason and wisdom, and by its application live lives of virtue and excellence. For secular humanists, ethical conduct is or should be judged by critical reason. Their goal is to develop autonomous and responsible individuals capable of making their own choices in life based on understanding of human behavior. H.J. Blackham, the humanist, puts it very simply, man will become in the ethical sense his own creator. It really is simply up to us to decide what good and evil are. And again, another quotation from the Secular Humanist Declaration, I think from 1967. The problems that humankind will face in the future, as in the past, will no doubt be complex and difficult. However, if it is to prevail, it can only do so by enlisting resourcefulness and courage. Secular humanism places trust in human intelligence rather than divine guidance. Skeptical of theories of redemption, damnation, and reincarnation, secular humanists attempt to approach the human situation in realistic terms. Human beings are responsible for their own destinies. And again, just a little way down, Blackham again. Humanism is naturalist instead of supernaturalist. It will have nothing to do with absolutes. Absolute truth, absolute morality, absolute perfection, and absolute authority. But insists that we, man, can find standards to which our actions and our aims can properly be related. And to see how strongly he thinks this, you see this next word here, any belief in absolutes, whether the absolute validity of moral commandments, of authority, of revelation, of inner certitude, of divine inspiration, erects a formidable barrier against progress and the possibility of improvement. Now, there are other quotations here, and you can look at these later. But the consequence of this, if we want to think about that for a moment, and we'll come back to it later, is very challenging. And I'll just take one example of this from on page 2, right in the middle. Peter Singer, it's on the back side of your first sheet. Peter Singer is a Australian who teaches ethics at Princeton University. And some of you may have seen articles about him, about his thinking, 2 or 3 years back when he was first appointed to the post, because there was quite a lot of protest against his appointment. And there were some fascinating articles about his views at the time. But Peter Singer would be a kind of model example of someone who passionately believes that we need to dispense with the whole notion of God, of God's revelation, the Bible, of Christ, of God's commandments directing our lives, who passionately believes it's up to us And I want to read this one example from his writing because it gives you an idea of where this leads. He's talking about the issue of what do we do with people who are disabled in some way, physically or mentally, and particularly with newborn children who are damaged seriously in one way or another. And he writes this: once the religious mumbo-jumbo surrounding the term human has been stripped away, we may continue to see normal members of our species as possessing greater capacities of rationality, self-consciousness, communication, and so on, than members of any other species. But we will not regard as sacrosanct the life of each and every member of our species, no matter how limited its capacity for intelligent or even conscious life may be. If we compare a severely defective human infant with a non-human animal, a dog or a pig, for example, we will often find the non-human to have superior capacities, both actual and potential, for rationality, self-consciousness, communication, and anything else that can be plausibly be considered morally significant. Only the fact that defective infant is a member of the species Homo sapiens leads it to be treated differently from the dog or pig. Species membership alone, however, is not morally relevant. It was because of these views that there were such protests from some people against his appointment at Princeton. And the effect of this, of course, is not only in what you say about newborn babies, but also about elderly people who are suffering from senile dementia or Alzheimer's. My father-in-law, for example, is really struggling with senile dementia right now. It's progressing fairly rapidly. My wife is out in California with her parents right now, helping to look after her dad and just encouraging her mother. And it's tragic seeing what has been happening to him over the last several years. With Alzheimer's disease, of course, and I'm sure some of you have members of your own family who struggle with that, it is, of course, even worse because there are dramatic personality changes as well as the gradual shrinking of the brain. A very dear friend of mine who was an elder in the church where I was a pastor for many years in England was just diagnosed this past year with Alzheimer's, and he's just my age. He's in his late 50s. And the earlier you get it, the more rapid the advance. Now, Peter Singer's words were applied by him, of course, to people at the end of their lives as well, until his own mother became ill with Alzheimer's. And he wrote some things about this afterwards, and thankfully it has caused him to begin to reconsider. But it's astonishing that anybody should develop such ethical views without actual reflection on how they would deal with an issue like this in their own family, in their own life. But Peter Singer is, as I said, a kind of model example of what happens if you say we are dependent on simply reason and science alone to give us ethical values, provide for us a distinction between what is good and what is evil. Now, no matter how someone like Peter Singer or H.J. Blackham or the Secular Humanist Declaration or anyone else, no matter how it is dressed up with scientific language or presented as if it were giving us a solid foundation for ethical standards, it becomes very quickly apparent that if you reject God, either in the sense of saying he doesn't exist or saying we don't really know anything about him or God has not spoken to us to reveal to us how we are to live, that if we don't have a word from God, then we have to say that humanity, human beings, are the only source of law, the only source for knowing the distinction between good and evil. If God is silent, if God is not spoken, then we really are on our own to find out for ourselves, simply as human persons, what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. Now, if we take such a view, there are really only four possible options. And I want to go quickly through those for you. But before we do, look at this quotation right under the Singer one from Jean-Paul Sartre, because he's making this point very strongly. When we speak of abandonment, Sartre wrote, we only mean to say that God does not exist, or we might say that God is silent, because it really makes no difference here if God is not spoken, and that it's necessary to draw the consequences of his absence or his silence right to the end. And then this quote that I actually gave you earlier, the existentialist is strongly opposed to a certain type of secular moralism which seeks to suppress God at the least possible expense. And then at the bottom of the page he says this, it must be considered obligatory by such a person to be honest, not to lie, not to beat one's wife, to bring up children, and so forth. We're going to do a little work on this subject which will enable us to show that these values exist all the same, even though there is no God. Now Sartre goes on to say, if you look right down the middle of the page there at the shortest quote there, just down below the middle, Sartre says, every man without any support or help whatever is condemned at every instant to invent man. If God has not spoken, we are on our own. So, if God is silent, there are only four possible options. The first is this, and this is really Sartre's view. The individual decides for himself or herself. Again, Sartre simply puts it like this. Man is condemned to be free. Man is condemned, he says, to invent man. In other words, the individual has total responsibility for oneself. Now, we need to understand that that is very much the context in which we live, where many of the people around us, even though the overwhelming majority would say they believe in God, when it comes down to their life practically from day to day, believe that morality is their choice. It's what they choose to do for themselves as an individual, whether it comes to questions of human life, questions of sexuality, questions of business practice, or whatever the issue is, telling the truth or whatever. It's really up to me to decide what is right and what is wrong for me. There is a passage in the Bible which expresses this precisely from the end of the book of Judges. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Everyone did as he saw fit. Now, that's the first option. The second is this, and that is that the majority will decide for us. If you look at the next quotation down there, it's from the novelist William Golding, most well known for his novel The Lord of the Flies, about a group of children whose plane crashes on an island. And Golding wrote this: if God is dead, if man is the highest, good and evil is defined by majority vote. Now, again, we need to acknowledge that this is very much the setting in which we live. It is, I suppose, only in the last 10 or 15 years at the most that in several of our states we have begun to have referenda on all sorts of moral questions, on whether there should be homosexual marriage, on questions of euthanasia and assisted suicide, issues of abortion, etc. Now, what is happening, and if you are a Christian, you need to reflect very carefully about this, because often Christians will get excited about this and say, well, now we can get out there and vote and make sure that we have some good laws. But we need to really understand what's happening in the culture in which we live. Many Americans think now that this is what democracy is, that government by the people is the people deciding what is right and wrong. As that's certainly not what anybody till just a very few years ago thought democracy was. To simply consult the people, to ask them, is it right to kill or let live? Are certain kinds of sexual behavior right or wrong? Such questions cannot be decided by 51% of the people, even if all of the people vote, which of course we certainly don't. Now, this direction, whether it's actually having referenda or whether it's having opinion polls, and sadly many of our politicians are governed by such polls about what their constituents think is right or wrong, rather than by their own personal moral convictions, this direction where we ask, well, what do the people think, is an enormously difficult problem for us in our society. It doesn't help us to decide what is truly right and wrong. Terrible evil may be done by the majority. The majority of people in Nazi Germany went along with what Hitler was doing. Does that make it right? Of course it doesn't. But if, in fact, good and evil are decided by human persons, then there really is nothing one can say against either of these positions. Either the individual can choose, or that we'll consult the majority, because we need some kinds of standards so that we may have an orderly society. The third option is that those in power will decide for us. We might simply express this as might is right. Might is right. Now those, obviously when we think of the powerful, we think of political dictators like Adolf Hitler in Nazi Germany, deciding what was right for people in terms of who should live and who should die, whether it was Jewish people, gypsies, in some cases Christians, those who were mentally handicapped, people with epilepsy, all sorts of people were just simply exterminated at the will of the dictator, whether it's someone like him or someone like Saddam Hussein today, who has done terrible things to his own population, gassing people, killing thousands and thousands of the Marsh Arabs and Kurds and Kurds and many other people. So, simply an expression of this third possibility, that might is right. But there are other forms of this as well, as simply someone like Hitler or Saddam Hussein. There are other kinds of powerful groups as well, who seek to impose their will on societies. And we wrestle with this in our own culture, with powerful groups seeking to impose their views on all of us through the courts, through the Congress, through the media, through wealthy business interests, or whatever. Many of the issues, for example, regarding embryo experimentation are decided simply by those who wish to do such work, who wish to be involved in what are considered to be medical advances. Those questions have not generally been decided either by governments, by courts, but simply by those doing the work. In other words, by powerful elites. But there are some very serious ethical issues involved. Is this human life that is being experimented on? That's the third option. The fourth is that an ideology will decide for us. Now, the obvious example here is Marxism. Terrible evil may be done in the name of some supposed ultimate good. And I've included here a quotation which I came across many, many years ago in Time magazine, written by David Aikman. And he was writing about what happened in Kampuchea, and this was just back in the 70s, 25 or so years ago, 25 to 30 years ago. And he expresses the issues so well, I'll simply read this to you. If you remember the situation, and we forget these things so quickly, it is probable that during the rule of Pol Pot in Kampuchea, that at least a third of the population were killed in the name of the Marxist revolution which he was leading. Maybe even more. But at least a third of the population. He writes, "Where the insane reversal of values lies is in the belief that notions like purity or corruption can have any meaning outside an absolute system of values, one that is resistant to the tinkering at will by governments or revolutionary groups. The Cambodian revolution, in its own degraded purity, has demonstrated what happens when the Marxian denial of moral absolutes is taken with total seriousness by its adherents. Pol Pot and his friends decide what good is, what bad is, and how many corpses must pile up before the rapacious demon of purity is appeased." Basically, what he did was turn the whole country into a concentration and extermination camp, in the name of making a new beginning, a new society which would arise like a phoenix out of the ashes of the old one. Everybody who wore glasses, for example, was considered to be an intellectual and educated person, was just killed. People had to hide the fact that they were educated. And then David Aikman applies it to our own situation. "In the West today, there is a pervasive consent to the notion of moral relativism, a reluctance to admit that absolute evil can and does exist." Now, that's true even after 9/11, as that first article we looked at says. "This makes it especially difficult for some to accept the fact that the Cambodian experience was something far worse than a revolutionary aberration. Rather, it is the deadly, logical consequence of an atheistic, man-centered system of values enforced by fallible human beings with total power who believe with Marx that morality is whatever the powerful define it to be, and with Mao, that power grows from gun barrels. Now, one of the things I want to point out to you here is this. The more confident that one is that humanity is the only source of law and of the knowledge of good and evil, then the more readily terrible evil can be done. The more utopian somebody is, the more they believe that it is possible to create an ideal society, then the worse will be the things that they do. It's precisely because Marxism was utopian, because it had no sense of original sin, that human beings are fatally flawed, morally corrupted, all of us, because there is no sense of that, and because there is this belief that we define for ourselves what good and evil is, then terrible evil will be done. The more utopian somebody is, the greater will be the evil they can do once they are in power. That's why our own form of government, with its acknowledgement that evil, that power corrupts people, is so significant. There is the recognition of evil in the human heart. But once that's denied, and we say that human beings decide for us what is right and wrong, then terrible evil can be done. Now, the more our culture lives, and let me come back to the main point here. We've said that without God, or if God is silent, then morality, good and evil, are simply down to human beings. And one of these four options. Now, if we come back to our own culture at the present time, the more our culture lives with the absence or silence of God, the more deeply relativistic, the more deeply pessimistic, and the more cynical it will become. I don't know how many of you saw the film American Beauty, but it's a very fine example of this. A terrible cynicism about the human condition. That there really is no way in the end to say what is right and what is wrong, and that life means anything ultimately at all. Now, I am not saying that everyone around us has lost their moral character completely in their own personal lives. My parents, as I mentioned earlier, were an example of deeply moral people who had no ultimate foundation for their convictions and behavior. So I'm not saying that everyone around us is completely immoral. There were wonderful examples after 9/11 of extraordinary moral heroism by many people, both Christians and unbelievers. There are many wonderful examples of moral integrity and uprightness and heroism in our society. However, we live in a setting where there is a steady slide into what I'll call a relativistic abyss. Let me finish with something I was constantly in the news when I was over in England this summer. In Britain, everywhere right now, they are facing an enormous problem with crime by children. Very serious crime. Petty theft has been almost universal in Britain for many, many years. We moved here 14 years ago, but long before we moved, You couldn't leave a bicycle outside your house in your driveway, a skateboard, a basketball, anything. You couldn't leave your car unlocked. Everything was stolen. It didn't matter whether you lived in the city, in the suburbs, in the countryside. That is universally the situation right across Britain. Petty theft is extraordinarily widespread, everywhere, by little children and by adults as well. But increasingly, over the last few years, there has been a growth of tremendous violence by young children as well. Again, and it doesn't matter where you live. It's not simply a problem of situations of poverty, of unemployment, of urban decay. In Britain, it's everywhere, in the cities, in the suburbs, in the countryside. And what people are demanding at the present time is that the government of Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, do something about it. They do something to the educational system so that children will stop being criminals all over the place. Of course, there's nothing really the government can do about it if parents are not teaching their children what is right and wrong. It is extremely difficult for the schools to fill in what parents are failing completely to do. But that problem, which is so widespread in Britain, is a problem which is growing here as well. Just on the news today, I heard about a man in Milwaukee who was beaten to death by a group of teenagers and even children as young as 10 years old. We are facing the same problems increasingly here as are being faced all over Britain and Western Europe. They're just a little further down this road than we are here. But if you want to know where our society is heading, look at where Western Europe is right now, because that's the direction in which we're going. Now I need to stop there, and we'll take a break here, and a little bit over time, but I'm sure Joellen will forgive me.